This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The world has plenty of images of people being horrible to one another to fill our computer and television screens for a lifetime. So why is it that when a group turns its destructive focus toward an ancient site or historic artifacts, this still has the power to stop our breath? It was like that in 2001 when the Taliban dynamited the ancient, massive Buddhas of Bamiyan. It was a statement about their desire to wipe out thousands of years of history, and it made the world take notice. Today, one of the world's other great cultural sites, the city of Palmyra in Syria, is under the control of the self-proclaimed Islamic State, or ISIS. The worry for historians is not just that the city's trove of antiquities would be destroyed, but that they would be looted and sold to fund more terrorist activity. U.S. House lawmakers passed legislation to make it illegal to sell looted artifacts from Syria, but in the case of sites like Palmyra in parts of Iraq, it might already be too late. Today, Where We Live, preserving our world's cultural treasures, you can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll also consider throughout the course of this program how we keep our own treasures safe here in the U.S. and how natural disasters like the Nepal earthquake might even pose a bigger threat than the wars that we watch around the world. Joining us in studio for this hour to talk through some of these issues is Stéphane Simon, who is the director of the Institute for the Preservation of Cultural Heritage at Yale University. He joins us today in Hartford. Thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Good morning, John.
I also want to welcome in by phone Amar Al-Azam, who is an associate professor of history and anthropology at Shawnee State University, and he's chair of the Syrian Heritage Task Force. I want to welcome you to the program. You've been following what's been going on in Syria closer than just about anyone, and unfortunately, you have news to tell us just even this morning that you find out about another museum, another place with some very important antiquities, which has been bombed in Syria. What can you tell us today?
Hi, yes. I'm literally reading the information as it comes in from our teams on the ground inside Syria. The city of Mara has a small museum, but the museum contains an exceedingly important collection of mosaics that come from the nearby sites of the dead cities. These sites date back from the 3rd to the 5th century AD, and they produce some of the most important mosaics in the region, and they're also designated as a World Heritage Site by UNESCO. Yesterday, the city itself had been under consistent barrel bombing by the regime. It's been a very aggressive campaign, and yesterday a barrel bomb landed on top of the museum, and the pictures are appalling, and I'm just reading right now the damage. I asked how bad is the damage to the actual, museum collection. He says the damage is great. Now I'm just speechless. I just don't know what to say. I'm close to tears on this.
And
we spent a lot of time trying to save this museum. We were worried. We've been concerned about the barrel bombing, and we've passed this information to the regime saying, please do not target the museum. And we even sandbagged it back last in February. We were able to complete this 2015. We were able to finally get sandbags to put on top of the mosaics to try and protect them just in case an incident like this happens. And now it has. And I'm just waiting for the photos. They're going back inside to now see how, assess the damage and send us a damage report.
And again, we're hearing from Amar Al-Azam, who has helped to preserve cultural heritage sites in Syria. And we brought together this program in part to talk about the threat in Syria and Iraq from ISIS, the self-proclaimed Islamic State. But you're telling us today that the bombing that you're seeing pictures of now at this museum, the Mara Museum, which you have been working to protect, this is actually blown up essentially by the Assad regime.
Yes, look, the damage to Syria's cultural heritage predates ISIS. Obviously, ISIS is a major aggressor against cultural heritage. There's no doubt about it. But the damage to Syria's cultural heritage began before. It began in 2012 when there was a fundamental shift in the nature of the conflict in Syria from one of peaceful protests, civil activities, to an armed confrontation between the regime and the opposition. Since end of 2011 and early 2012, we began to see a marked increase in the damage to Syria's cultural heritage, whether by looting, opportunistic, what we also refer to as subsistence looting, just people trying to make ends meet, and they're just trying to sell, you know, dig up stuff and sell it just to feed themselves, to coordinated and organized looting by you know, criminal elements to fund themselves privately, and then later on by local militias and so on and so forth. But then you have, and then there's also the damage obviously caused by the fact that these sites were caught in the crossfire between the two sides that are fighting. And so all of this has really been causing a serious problem to the cultural heritage, and the damage has been, you know, really, really significant to so many sites. And then you have on top of that ISIS that takes it to the next level. Obviously, this is where ISIS starts to aggressively and loot sites and institutionalizes the looting, in addition to the atrocities they commit against monuments and museums and so on and so forth.
You said that this was a very small museum, but a very important museum. How many sites like this have you been involved in helping to protect and preserve?
Bear in mind that Syria's, at the moment, basically is divided into different sort of areas or zones of control, and only 30% or so of Syria is still in under regime control, or I should also say accessible to the state institutions such as the DJM, and they've managed to save what they can in those areas. But 70% of the country is outside that, and we try to operate in that 70% that is outside regime control. But this is, most of the work is done by local activists, local museum curators, local archaeologists who are very concerned about what's happening there, and they've been working hard for the last 4 years trying to save what they can, either by documenting the damage that they see and then filing these reports in, or by intervention, small-scale interventions like the one at the Mara Museum. We've done similar stuff in Idlib, when the city was changed hands recently. We've tried to do these things in the city of Aleppo. Different groups, it's not just my group, there are lots of different little groups working. It's like a loose-knit network, if you want, if that's one way of describing it, all working under most difficult conditions and with little or no support from the international community to try and achieve these simple kind of preservation, if you want, efforts to save what they can, because they do understand the value of their cultural heritage and they do realize that this is something that's going to be very important for their future.
I want to bring in Stéphane Simon to just maybe react to some of what you've heard, because obviously our entire program was to talk about this very thing. But part of the framing mechanism for many of us in the West is seeing this threat from ISIS taking over parts of Iraq and Syria, looting the cultural heritage of this place. And I think back to 2001, and I think to the Taliban and the Buddhas of Bamiyan with this seeming disregard for, you know, millennia of history. Here you're hearing an on-the-ground report essentially about the Assad regime, which has controlled Syria for so many years, blowing up its own cultural heritage. Stéphane, what's your reaction?
It's as Amr said, it's heartbreaking to hear this news. It's truly heartbreaking to hear that, and we know our colleagues of the DGAM, of the Department of Antiquities and Museums, they're trying a lot to preserve the cultural heritage, to bring objects to secure places, and if you hear news like that, it's truly heartbreaking, and I have actually no words, because I'm often asked this question: who is behind these attacks? And I'm reluctant to, because I just out of a lack of knowledge, I'm reluctant to blame parties, because we know, for example, Palmyra looting has been going on since years. There was a wave of looting in 2012-13 as well. There's several parties involved. Really unprecedented, in my opinion, characteristic of this development is that we are standing in front of a massive destruction of cultural heritage in the region, in the Middle East. But we go just back a few years. We also have that in Mali with the occupation of Timbuktu. 2012, we see the Boko Haram destroying the World Heritage Site in the north of Nigeria. And you mentioned the Bamiya in 2001. We had a similar experience in the 1990s in Bosnia, when cultural heritage, I think, became a target, not just the collateral damage, but really became a target between the religious communities in Bosnia. But the last year has been a very bad year for cultural heritage. And when Amr is mentioning the museum in Mara, yeah, it's heartbreaking. On the other hand, we know about what happens in Sana'a, which was once called, you know, Happy Arabia. The war destroying world heritage in a world heritage city like Sana'a. For us working in the preservation of cultural heritage, these are not very encouraging days. No.
What can you tell us about the historic sites at Palmyra, which are under such threat right now, and as you say, have been looted for years now as this ongoing Syrian civil war continues? But what can you tell us about the importance of this place, Stefan?
Well, it is a World Heritage Site. That means it is defined by an outstanding universal value. The value is in its architecture. It's actually a very interesting example of an intercultural site where you can actually read influences from the Roman Empire, from the Persian Empire, from Assyrian. I mean, this flowering period was when it was at the crossroad of a trade road which came from China to the Roman Empire. And it's so much in contrast of what we are seeing today. It actually shows cultural heritage in its significance of actually bringing people together, of uniting people. And I think that's the time to reflect upon that, how intercultural and how mutually, I mean, promoting cultural heritage can be for various cultures. It's never just one influence. You see that all over the world. I mean, you see that in Europe, and Palmyra is a very good example for that. That's not a unilateral. It's not just one culture made that famous colonnaded street and that famous site.
Amr, what can you tell us about the status of Palmyra today and the most important sites and antiquities there?
As far as Palmyra is concerned, I mean, obviously, our biggest concern vis-a-vis ISIS is primarily the looting. Not because ISIS is the only looter out there, and as Stefan quite rightly mentioned, and I also mentioned earlier on, looting was going on, and it occurs and is happening it's taking part by all sides of the conflict, from even before ISIS came about. But what ISIS did, and that's what really changed the dynamic of the looting, is it institutionalized it. Whereas earlier on, it was very much, as I said, opportunistic looting. It was looting by small groups, organized criminal elements or whatever. It was haphazard. And even though it was causing a significant amount of damage, nothing compared to what ISIS then comes and does. Because ISIS essentially comes upon this pre-existing situation and then decides to institutionalize it. It starts to issue licenses. It starts to oversee the activities, and it also brings in heavy earth-moving equipment, bulldozer trucks. And we have photographs of this kind of work. And this is really why we are very concerned about ISIS. And we know that ISIS intends to loot the actual site of Palmyra. Now, the museum itself has been pretty much emptied by our colleagues from the Department of Antiquities in Damascus. They were able to do that literally at the 11th hour, even as ISIS were breaking into the city. The trucks were leaving from the other end with, you know, carrying the material, the contents of the museum. And that's, I think, you know, a testament to their efforts. But unfortunately, Palmyra as a site is very, very rich, and it's not very difficult to access the material. The desert that Palmyra sits in, the ruins are and the tombs that and the archaeological layers are not very deep, so it's fairly easy to kind of dig them up and get to them. And this is going to be something that ISIS is now going to probably engage in. So far, they have not destroyed any of the monuments there, and they've said, in fact, in a public statement that they're not going to do so. But I believe that ISIS will ultimately and eventually engage in a cultural heritage atrocity. But you know, that is going to be for propaganda purposes and not for obviously looting purposes. And that's there's a whole different set of reasons why ISIS commits any atrocity in the first place.
And that's what I wanted to get to, Amr, and I'd like you both to comment on this. But for many of our listeners, and I'm sure many people who follow these stories around the world, they look at this and they say, ISIS, and indeed that the entire Syrian civil war, is causing so much human misery. There are so many people who are being killed and displaced. Why should we, as a society, worry so much about these ancient things when so many people are being destroyed on a daily basis? As someone whose life's work is in this, make that case for us, Amr. Tell us why this is so important.
Okay. Well, I mean, first I'll answer that part, and I'll go back and address some of the other issues you mentioned quickly. Look. This conflict is going to, first of all, I just don't think it's fair, and I don't think we should see this as an either-or, issue. This should not be, we either save people or we save cultural heritage. Both need to be saved for the following reason. This conflict in Syria will one day end, and this conflict has ruptured Syrian society on every possible cleavage. And Syrians, when this war ends, are going to have to, you know, look through the ruined parts of their society and their lives and try to find common denominators that somehow bring them back together again, that somehow allow them to feel once more as Syrians. What makes a Syrian a Syrian? And, you know, their shared common history, their shared common experiences, and their cultural heritage is a very significant part of that shared common history. It's going to come and play a very important role in helping bridge those gaps, help bring Syrians back together again. So if we lose this cultural heritage, essentially we'll lose a very important opportunity to heal this country and somehow move on. Reconciliation cannot, I believe personally, that we cannot have reconciliation if we don't have, clear points of coming together. And so, in effect, saving Syria's past is also about saving Syria's future. As to the other issue of why ISIS destroys cultural heritage, ISIS doesn't just destroy cultural heritage. ISIS commits atrocities. There is a political propaganda purpose for that, whether it's burning a pilot, whether it's setting fire to them, whether it's beheading people on cameras, or whether it's blowing up a shrine or blowing up a museum or an archaeological site. All of these are designed to send a very powerful propaganda message. The ability of ISIS to act with impunity and the impotence of the international community to respond to these acts of impunity. And it's a very powerful combination that ISIS, that resonates well with its very narrow base and also sends a very powerful message to the outside world. And ISIS uses that to good effect. And often it is associated with a setback. You look at when these atrocities have occurred. They usually have occurred around a time when we've had a setback. So if we want to think that now maybe ISIS has just had a setback in northern Syria, now would be the time if ISIS is thinking of committing an atrocity, and they might be looking to Palmyra as a potential source of atrocity. And as for the religious component, please remember that ISIS uses religious texts and religious explanations and Quranic verses to justify the atrocity and not the other way around. The religious component, the atrocity is not to fulfill a religious requirement. The religious component is used as a justification for any of the atrocities they've committed, and destroying cultural heritage as an atrocity is no different, really, than burning someone alive. Both are used to the same effect.
Stefan?
This debate about human needs and loss of life, we have that everywhere. We have that also in Nepal after the earthquake. And it's, of course, it's clear that the human safety and well-being comes first. And, rescuing human lives is the first priority. But as Amr said, I think that's not really an either-or situation. I think the cultural heritage, actually, even in a moment of despair, like after an earthquake, after a big flood, rescuing, safeguarding, protecting cultural heritage with emergency measures can contribute to help build the dignity of the people, identifying the roots of the civilization. Being proud, taking pride in the history, in the achievements of the society, of the civilization, which actually is a very strong point in countries like Syria, who have a very rich history, cultural history. And I think it shouldn't be really an either or. I think those are the roots of civilization, and if the society wants to develop and build, as Amr said also, at some future point, reconciliate, which is a very strong word, but cultural heritage bears the root. I mean, it's so closely linked to the human condition that it shouldn't be seen as old stones laying somewhere around in the desert. It's very important, and yeah. I couldn't agree more with Amr said at some point that it's really it's as much about the past as it's about the future. I think cultural heritage preservation is very much about the future.
And as he says, something to rally around, something for people to actually have as a common touchstone around their humanity. Amr al-Azam, we should let you go, but I appreciate you very much joining us. And perhaps we'll check in later on to see if you have more news about this latest atrocity happening at the Maurer Museum, which you've worked so hard to protect. I thank you for joining us. I'm very sorry for this news to come out on the radio today, but I'm glad you're able to talk to us about it a bit.
Thank you very much.
This is Where We Live, and when we come back from our break, we're going to be talking more about preserving antiquities and cultural heritage around the world. We're going to be talking about some of the legal frameworks, both internationally and nationally, that are put around this. We're going to take some of your phone calls as well at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about preserving cultural treasures around the world, especially in conflict zones. We started this program wanting to talk about the Syrian city of Palmyra, which has come under the influence of the so-called Islamic State. But in our first segment, we heard from our guest Amr al-Azam that the Assad regime has just within the last day bombed a very important museum outside the city of Idlib called the Maurer Museum. Again, destroying many cultural artifacts. We don't know if there's loss of life there as well, but we were speaking with someone who's very, very involved in the preserving of cultural antiquities. Stefan Simon is as well. He's director of the Institute for the Preservation of Cultural Heritage at Yale University. He joins us in studio today. And I want to welcome in now by phone Patty Gerstenbluth, who's a professor of law and director of the Center for Art, Museum, and Cultural Heritage Law at DePaul University. I believe that we have Patty Gerstenbluth not in Chicago, though, today, but overseas. And Patty, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I very much appreciate you joining us. There's a lot that we want to talk about in this program, but one of the things we wanted to get to is some conversation about the market for these antiquities. As we hear about looting that's been going on in places like Palmyra for years now, many of us who are outside of this world wonder, well, how could it possibly be that someone could take something so important from an ancient city and then sell it on the open market and actually get money for it? How exactly does this market exist, Patty?
Well, it's not really that difficult because archaeological artifacts, particularly things that are looted directly from the ground, are undocumented and therefore can be sold either without provenance or with a fake provenance as if they were legitimate. So it's a difficult task to determine what may be recently looted as opposed to something that might have been excavated 100 or 150 years ago. And the market just subsists through many, many different venues and circles around. It goes through different countries, the artifacts, and eventually many of them do surface on what we can call the legitimate market, particularly through dealers that are not very transparent about what they are doing, and also the internet auction sites that are a relatively recent phenomenon.
Who are the buyers? Who wants this stuff?
Well, lots of people will want it. Very few people would buy something at the end of the market knowing that it was recently looted. But many people engage in what we can call willful ignorance or conscious avoidance of the source of objects. And so things will pass from dealer to dealer and, as I said, eventually may surface in an auction house or in a more prominent dealer and will be bought by collectors and perhaps eventually donated to a museum, particularly in the United States. But it will come at that point without clear indication of whether it was something recently looted or, as I said, that was found many, many years ago and therefore would be considered to be legal at this point in time.
What is the scope of international law that governs this world?
Well, it's a real patchwork, and that's the unfortunate part. You have a combination of international treaties, particularly the 1970 UNESCO Cultural Property Agreement. On the one hand, we also have the 1954 Hague Convention that aims to protect cultural property during armed conflict. For example, the story that you mentioned earlier, if it's verified that the Assad regime bombed a museum that it knew perfectly well where that museum was located, that would clearly be a violation of international law, an egregious violation. But in terms of the market, we have, as I said, the 1970 UNESCO Convention, but it's only as has the force of law to the extent that different countries have ratified it and how they implement it. And many countries implement it in a very sort of haphazard way, is what I will say. We now also have special rules and regulations in force that apply specifically to Syria and also to Iraq. For example, in February, the United Nations Security Council adopted a binding, in other words, requirement of all countries to enact import restrictions for artifacts that were removed illegally from Syria after the beginning of the revolt in March of 2011. Many countries, including, I should say, in fact, at this point, the United States is the only Western market country that has not implemented a required import restriction under that Security Council resolution. And the European countries, particularly the European Union, the UK, Switzerland, have all enacted import restrictions, in fact, often as criminal provisions. Right now, we have pending in Congress a bill passed in the House last week unanimously, H.R. 1493, which has now been sent to the Senate. We are waiting for the Senate to act on that. And it is crucial that the Senate act quickly and effectively to put these import restrictions to an effect, in effect, because we don't want the United States to become the market for these kinds of objects that are being looted today from Syria and from parts of Iraq that are destroying the cultural heritage, something that's crucial to the identity of the Syrian people, but also something that we believe is funding ISIL and other terrorist activities. So this is a crucial action that United States Congress needs to take as soon as possible. And it's one thing that we can do here in the United States that would have an effect.
Stéphane Simon, I wonder if you might comment on this. Something I've thought a lot about as we were preparing for this program is the attempt globally to stop the sale of ivory products taken from African elephants. And there's two sides to this trade. On one side, there is trying to stop people from poaching elephants and putting actually armed militias on the ground to stop that work. But on the other end, there has to be some sort of way to control the market, because as long as there's a market, people will poach elephants. It feels very much the same way, but as I'm hearing this from Patty, the patchwork of laws is not terribly strong when it comes to preserving antiquities, and it's very hard on the other end, as we heard from Amr before, to protect things on the ground as well, Stéphane.
That's definitely true. I have exactly the same impression. We can learn a lot from our colleagues in the nature and wildlife preserve field. I'm working in this field for more than 20 years, and I'm always wondering why, for example, any egg in a supermarket has to have a stamp where it was laid, where it does come from. You know, every egg in the European Union, at least, I don't know so much about this country, but in Europe. But that doesn't apply to cuneiform tablets and ushebtis and mosaics. And I'm just wondering how museums who have the task to educate visitors, to disseminate knowledge, just don't seem to care so much about provenance. I mean, I have been as a chemist. I'm not, unlike Patty, I'm not a legal expert. I'm just a simple conservation scientist. But I have been involved in authenticating and investigations of cultural heritage for antiquities, but also for modern art. I really wonder why that is the case. Why we have that? Why it's still sufficient to say, well, that was in an old Swiss family for how many years, and then it can be sold. I do believe that we have to really develop a strategy. And Patty mentioned, you know, the UNESCO Convention 1970, which unfortunately I think applies, to my knowledge, Patty may correct me, but applies only to nationally listed objects, not really to objects which come out of the ground. We have, you know, for example, Germany ratified that convention in 2007, so really late. And we have, you know, the United Nations Security Council 2199. We have actually also a decision of the General Assembly 69-281, just end of May. And I do believe that what we need is really a long-term strategy to just ban the illicit traffic of cultural heritage. I mean, we should make that a public concern and make it socially unacceptable. I mean, that is, I think, the bottom line of what UNESCO is aiming at with Unite for Heritage, which, you know, several governments in Europe, as Patty pointed out, Switzerland, Germany, others are now trying to do. We have to turn the tide here.
But Patty, how difficult would it be, do you believe, to do what Stefan is suggesting, that essentially, like almost every product that's made in the West, it can be easily tracked globally? Can we begin to start to make sure that each country is labeling in some way these artifacts so that we know where they're going and who they belong to?
Well, yes, but I think that there are several hurdles, both legal and practical, that we have to get past. The practical is that even this legislation that's pending in Congress to prevent the import of recently looted archaeological material and other cultural materials from Syria, even that has had some active lobbying against it, both from the museum community and from some of the dealer community, if you can imagine that. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine that people would actually be opposing that. So there's a real political problem in many countries. It's a problem in Germany, where their implementation of the 1970 Convention is even weaker. It's one of the weakest countries in the world for implementing the 1970 UNESCO Convention. The U.S. implementation, which goes back to 1983, is more limited but is more effective. I think the other problem is the labeling idea. You can say, fine, we should label every object, but objects that recently come out of the ground are not going to be labeled because they are unknown. They are looted from the ground, sold directly, smuggled out of the country to dealers in different countries. They, as I said, they pass around amongst different countries and eventually surface on the market in Europe and the United States and other countries. Those objects come inherently unmarked. I wish there were a way of marking them, but there isn't. And so the first we know about them is when they're on the market or in a museum or in a private collection that somehow becomes public, or if they're intercepted at the border. So there's an essential problem of this unknown quantity of objects where the objects themselves are previously unknown. And the looting of these objects is the most destructive to cultural heritage, because it destroys previously unknown information and sites and other objects that are not saleable on the market. At the same time, they are the most desirable for the market. If you steal something out of a museum, there's a much greater likelihood that it will be identified and whoever is dealing in it will be picked up by law enforcement. But if you're dealing in something previously unknown, it is clearly a better market for those kinds of objects, because law enforcement always has that burden of proof at some level to show that this is an illegal object. Again, if you want to change the law and reverse that burden of proof, it's not a bad idea, but I think politically it would be extremely difficult to accomplish. And certainly from a criminal law perspective, in the United States, of course, the presumption of innocence falls on the person who was accused of something. So reversing that burden of proof is very difficult.
Sure.
You can make it easier to intercept an object as opposed to criminally prosecuting somebody. The problem with that is that if you don't prosecute the dealers and the smugglers and the people involved in the networks, the smuggling and the looting will never stop.
I want to ask you both. Before we have to take our break, I want to ask you both this last question. It's a controversial thing, and I know it's something, Stefan, you've thought quite a bit about. Many people might say, well, look, a lot of the most important sites are in places that are in conflict or places that are very, very poor and unable to mount the type of resources necessary to truly preserve their great cultural treasures. Why not move many of them to places that are safer? Take them to a safe location in Switzerland, in the United States, and protect them from the dangers of whether it's ISIL or an earthquake or global warming. Stefan, what do you say to that?
Well, I don't think that is an option at all. I mean, in there might be an option in singular cases when you get an object, like the British Museum did recently, that it just, Neil McGregor said, we're going to keep that until we can return it. Or like this National Museum in Berlin is doing, that they're keeping maybe, you know, one or two objects which appear and which surface, and then, of course, with the immediate guarantee to return it to the country. I do believe, you know, that if you look at this illicit traffic, and I'm hoping actually for the legal experts to promote and forward that discussion, that we many people say that this is the third largest market, illegal market with weapons and drugs, you know. So it's easier to get artifacts across the border than it's to get money across the border. You mm-hmm. can try to come with money from Switzerland to Germany. You have dogs who can smell money, but you don't have dogs who can smell cuneiform tablets. And Interpol is also asking for that. The law enforcement agencies, they're asking for actually, you know, all the people involved and responsible for the trade, for you know, artifacts, trading artifacts, to really provide this information, to provide this kind of pedigree. This is not a new discussion. This is maybe now getting more to our attention because we learned that this money might be linked to financing terrorism. So we're like watching this a little bit closer. But this is something which is going on since a while. And I can only repeat myself. I think illicit traffic should be made socially unacceptable. And the idea of rescuing something, I mean, deliberately getting it out from the country to rescue it, I think that sounds very much like a 19th century idea.
Mm. Do you have any thoughts on that, Patty?
Well, I think if a foreign museum wanted, for example, to deposit objects in a foreign country, Switzerland, the United States, whatever, temporarily for purposes of safekeeping, I think that's perfectly fine, and I would love to see that happen. I think in terms of Syria and Iraq right now, I think there are many logistical difficulties there. But if it could be done, I think that would be great. But to intentionally buy something on the market that's been illegally taken, stolen, or looted is only encouraging more theft and more looting. Yes. And it also places the object above human life because we know that that money is going, at least to some extent, to funding more terrorism and more war. So I don't think we want to do anything that would have that purpose. So safekeeping, temporary, I think fine, but we should not do anything that would put money into the system that provides the economic incentive for more looting, more theft, more destruction.
Patty Gerstenbluth is a professor of law and director of the Center for Art, Museum, and Cultural Heritage Law at DePaul University. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
I'm going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with Stefan Simon from Yale University, and we'll also be talking more about preserving our own cultural treasures here in the United States, safeguarding them from things like climate change. That's coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, two big Connecticut corporations threatened to leave our state after the budget deal was reached. But were these empty threats? On the weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, our panel of reporters and observers will discuss some of the ongoing post-budget drama and some other stories in the week's news. Hope you can join us here on Where We Live. Today in the program, we're talking about preserving cultural treasures with Stefan Simon, who's director of the Institute for the Preservation of Cultural Heritage at Yale University. Joining us now by phone is Richard Curran, who's Undersecretary for History, Art, and Culture at the Smithsonian Institution. Richard, welcome to the program, first of all. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And we've been talking about historical antiquities in places like Palmyra in Syria and around the world that have been threatened. But right here in our own backyard, we have so many amazing treasures. And we want to know a little bit from you how we protect them here. I mean, maybe you can explain a little bit about how the Smithsonian protects and preserves the many tens of thousands of millions of items that it has under its control.
Well, you're right about it being millions. So the Smithsonian has about 138 million items in its collection, not counting archives and documents and photographs. So it takes quite a bit, and that's everything from microscopic prehistoric creatures to dinosaurs to space shuttles to the Hope Diamond. So it's an immense activity. The Smithsonian has a very large staff, 19 museums, a lot of professionals who are, you know, always involved in conservation and care of the materials. There's never enough staff. There's never enough money to do it. Materials, and Stefan could certainly tell you from as a, you know, materials scientist that, materials themselves do decompose, do go through life cycles. We're finding that right now with, for example, the spacesuits. One of the things we have in the Smithsonian collection, a great iconic object, you know, is the spacesuit of Neil Armstrong. Well, you know, it was made for space. It was made to withstand micrometeorites, extremes of heat on the moon and in space. And yet here on Earth, that very plastic is decaying. And, you know, so we're trying to figure out how to preserve even contemporary, modern-made, high-tech plastics.
My goodness, Stefan, that is amazing. Thinking about all of the things we've talked about today, as you mentioned, the cuneiform tablets, thousands of years old, stone that has stood the test of time, and here we are, we're watching these 1960s relics dissolve in front of our eyes?
Yes, indeed.
it's truly amazing. Well, Richard, one thing I want to talk about that I really think is important to our conversation here is, obviously, you know, Smithsonian, we hope, is not under any sort of threat of attack like in many conflict areas around the world, but we are all under a constant threat of climate change and global warming. And I guess I'm wondering if you can discuss that very specifically. How have you had to change some of your procedures or think about the ways in which you preserve and protect these items as we all see the climate changing, the possibility for large storms and other events like these?
Well, it's a great point, but just let me correct one thing in the historical records. During World War II, when Franklin Roosevelt was worried about an attack on Washington,
yes,
he ordered from the Smithsonian removed some of its treasures, the National Gallery of Art and Archives removed items to Fort Knox, to the Shenandoah Valley, to protect those artifacts because we thought they might be attacked here in Washington. Now, we haven't done anything like that in decades, thankfully. But you're exactly right in terms of things like climate change, storms, and so on. I think the nation had a wake-up call with Katrina, massive hurricane in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, which really had a tremendous impact on museums in that area. And, you know, while people were called for evacuation of people, many of our museum colleagues actually stayed in those museums to protect them because there weren't good plans to protect those items, either from the storms, from the devastating winds and so on and flooding, but also from possible looting here at home. Sandy is a great other case. You know, the Smithsonian got calls, as did FEMA and the National Cultural Heritage Task Force, about, you know, covered bridges, you know, in New England floating downstream. In New York, we had to evacuate the lower level of our American Indian Museum in Battery Park because it was flooded out. Artist studios, Martha Graham's costumes in New York, all affected because of, the rising water level. So I think as people both in the United States and around the world have anticipated the effects of, let's say, global warming, where you may have cultural sites. They may be historical churches or castles. They may be museums very close to water and rivers. As you anticipate, say, rising water levels, you have to change your storage techniques. You have to think about humidity. You have to think about the very structure and structural integrity of your museums and other historic and archaeological sites.
Yes, as we watched what happened to New Orleans, I couldn't help but to think of Venice, a city that's constantly sinking and already at sea level. Stefan, are there some examples you have of countries that you think do a very good job of planning in this way?
There are. Actually, unfortunately, it's not my home country, Germany. It's I have been in several hearings in the parliament, and I noticed that Germany wouldn't be prepared at all for an earthquake or a flood. In Berlin, we don't have a flood. We don't really have an earthquake. I mean, not that history knows. But natural disasters can come, you know. And actually, with the global climate change, I mean, the amount of severe weather conditions, storms, we have seen the first tornadoes, you know, cutting through our cities and villages, which I don't remember from my childhood. There are countries who are ahead of us. Switzerland is one. So Switzerland has a very good emergency response system, a triage system. They exactly know when they have to evacuate the museum, which objects they're going to take first and which second and which third. The Netherlands had a Delta Plan 10 years ago, which is another very interesting initiative for finding out the state of preservation in the museums. And then I would like to mention maybe the Denmark and Australia, who have both projects which are called significance, evaluation of significance for their collections. And so those are the countries who are aware that being prepared for any case of emergency on a political level, but down to the collections would be really good. If you have gone through, I mean, I can't forget, I was in 2002 at the Elbe flood in the Dresden Kunstsammlung, when two stories of the storage were flooded completely with water, and people from the street carried out all the paintings by famous painters. I mean, one of the most important painting collection in the world, the Staatliche Kunstsammlung. And that was only a combination of good luck and decided people to save the cultural heritage, which is actually what you're seeing today as well in Syria or in the affected countries in the Middle East. If you have people who really take responsibility for their cultural heritage, they might take the good decisions and rescue.
And that's a great point. And, you know, we've just seen, actually I'm heading down to Haiti in a week because we're dedicating a cultural conservation center there that grew out of the 2010 earthquake. And, you know, Haiti, poor country, under-resourced, did not have great inventories, emergency preparedness plans for its cultural collections, artistry, sculpture, and so on. Yet the first response from Haitians was indeed Haitians, mainly untrained, going into the rubble and pulling out their national treasures. Of course, you know, first saving survivors of the earthquake, attending to the deceased. But right away, in the first days after the earthquake, pulling treasures out of the rubble, and then depending on folks like the Smithsonian, the American Institute of Conservation, Blue Shield, and other organizations, ICRAM, a UN organization, coming forth to help provide training. And in the end, after that earthquake, we saved about 35,000 objects, from murals and churches and sculptures and thousands of paintings and historical documents. So, it takes that first. The first response is always going to be local institutions, local volunteers, people who are closest to that heritage, and then often you're going to need, outside help. I think the Japan tsunami was a great case in point. The Japanese are very well organized with regard to cultural inventories, plans, certainly abundant resources to deal with cultural heritage, especially under danger. But given that tsunami, given then the nuclear leak and everything else, even the Japanese were overwhelmed by the scale of disaster. And I think that's what gets to be scary, when you just get overwhelmed by these disasters. So you need good plans in place. In some cases, we need seismic isolation of institutions that has not been done in many earthquake places. Look at the recent case in Nepal. But we even have that in Los Angeles, where we have some institutions that have been seismically isolated. But I was in the castle here on the Mall in Washington at the Smithsonian, the first building of the Smithsonian, our initial museum, and that was damaged by an earthquake.
Well, the earthquake that was in Virginia not so many years ago.
Well,
Richard Curran from the Smithsonian, thank you so much for your time. And I want to thank Stéphane Simon from Yale University as well for joining us in this conversation about a really important issue. And if you want to continue the conversation, go to WNPR.org/where we live.